Maximum Niebuhr.
Let's get it.
You're listening to the Love Thy Niebuhr podcast, your home for discussion and analysis of the theology, ethics, and political philosophy of Reinhold Niebuhr.
Hey, and welcome back to the Love Thy Niebuhr podcast, still the only podcast out here putting in the work, dedicating ourselves to the theology, ethics, and political philosophy of Reinhold Niebuhr. I'm Cliff Bailey, and I'm joined as always by co-host Zach Narrison. We hope you all had a meditative Lent season and fulfilling Easter celebration. That means Jesus rose, but that also means Love Thy Niebuhr rises as well. Is that sacrilegious? Maybe.
Verging.
By this, I just mean we're back after a long break in the tomb of Niebuhrlessness, and we have risen to bring to you all a very special series this spring on Niebuhr and technology. And I'll explain why we're doing this series here in a second, but I first want to introduce our guest, who needs no introduction. He is the lone member of the Five-Timer Club. We just can't get enough of him. Last time he got an imaginary smoking jacket. This time I was thinking about like some really nice cufflinks, maybe. We'll see.
I could use a couple of nice cufflinks.
We'll see if Zach can set that up. He knows a guy. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
What have you been up to? Have any kids since we last talked?
Yeah. So I had a daughter last summer, last June. And so it's been a... It's been the happy chaos of early parenthood. And, we're 9 months in. I'm, probably 3 months behind on sleep at this point.
You're showing it in your face just a little bit.
There's no hiding it. There really isn't. I now understand why like parents look the way they do. I'm really starting to feel that, for myself, but obviously it's wonderful and transformative and really hard all at the same time.
And since the last time we spoke, you've been commissioned, you have been accepted for a new project that you're working on. You just want to take a moment to break that down for us just a little bit, just give us a little window into what you're working on.
So Oxford Press accepted a book proposal of mine, which has, it's in the drafting phases. I got certain parts of it complete. There's still a decent way to go, but the title of it, riffs off my dissertation, but this is not a Niebuhr book. It's got a Niebuhr chapter, but it's not a Niebuhr book. The working title at the moment is The Politics of Original Sin, Rethinking the World the Cold War Made.
Love it.
So it's basically the basic thesis that I'm working with is that the Cold War, for a variety of reasons, structured the way that we see the world. It created this imaginary that constructed the world in these very binary terms, these Manichaean terms of good versus evil. And that fused with these apocalyptic sensibilities that also went along with things like the nuclear bomb. So this combination of apocalypticism and Manichaeanism, I think, generated this tendency to see the conflict as, this cosmic showdown between good and evil with, the U.S. kind of like on the side of God.
Yeah.
And even in this post-Cold War era, I think we're still conditioned to construe the world in those starkly binary terms, with this kind of like apocalyptic and this Manichaean piece in our worldviews. And that's true regardless of whether one is aware of it. I think it's part of why we live in such a fractured, divided time is that we kind of instinctively construct the other side as like inherently evil.
Yeah.
And uncritically presume, our own goodness and the righteousness of our causes and stuff like that. So I want to draw on Niebuhr and this Augustinian realist tradition to help us rethink how good and evil function in the world, and to basically understand evil not as an ontological category, but as a relational category, that it really consists in, distorted ways of relating to good things. And that gives us a more nuanced approach. We can kind of own our own distorted ways of relating to good things, even as we fight for what we see as right. And it creates a window for seeing the good in people on the other side that really frustrate us and maybe are doing real harm.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's important to be blunt about that, but that they're redeemable in all of this. So how do we thread that needle? How do we move beyond this Manichaean moment? And I see Niebuhr as a figure that helps us kind of create a new moral imaginary where we think of good and evil in different terms.
And it's to be clear to our audience, it's not explicitly focused on Niebuhr. It's more about the mythology, right? And the Manichaeism and the building of these structures in our minds than it is explicitly about Niebuhr.
That's right. And my touchstone from Niebuhr in this is his book, The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness, which sounds extremely Manichaean.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting book. So he's writing Children of Light and Children of Darkness in 1944. The World War is still raging. It's just clear at this point that the Allies are going to win. And the title would make you think that Niebuhr is going to tell this like straightforward story about how, you know, this is like a showdown between good versus evil, light versus dark, and that democracy is going to triumph. But that's not what the book does at all, right? He basically tells his readers, the children of light have been foolish. Mm-hmm. That's how we got into this mess.
Love it.
To begin with, where we ended up, you know, getting built by figures like Hitler and Mussolini over and over again until we, you know, ended up with World War. And the children of darkness are wise, right? So this is riffing off of the parable of the unrighteous steward and Jesus concluding that with the enigmatic statement, you know, the children of darkness have been wiser in their generation than the children of light. So he's saying what we need to figure out if we want to rebuild the world in the post-Cold War era is how to absorb the wisdom of the children of darkness without absorbing their malice, right? The children of darkness have a read on how human nature works and how the aspects of human nature that we don't want to admit to ourselves, that whole shadow side works. And we need to be honest with ourselves about that shadow side if we want to start building a better world. And so he uses that to defend, basically make a case for democracy as a system that works with fallible humans.
Yeah.
And can help us negotiate our own shadow sides through this, you know, the system of checks and balances. Positions democratic theory as basically like the least worst option. And this is not like this like rah-rah democracy thing. He's just saying like, listen, democracy's flawed, but it's by far the best option we have going, just given what human nature is.
Yeah.
So it's a very different kind of argument for democracy. But the other thing I really like about that book is that there are only just a tiny handful of true children of darkness, right? He only names Hitler, Stalin, Napoleon. I think we're the only three people that he explicitly says these are children of darkness for sure.
Yeah.
So it leaves all this room for like, no, people who are like, you know, gung-ho about communist ideas that we might find troubling are still drawn to fascism. We can pull them in, right?
Yeah.
They're still redeemable. That part of why they're attracted to those philosophies, it's not because they're children of darkness, it's because they're foolish children of light.
Interesting.
And so it does provide this non-Manichaean way of working with political conflicts. And it's I almost position it as like the road not taken in the post-Cold War era. We went hard on this Manichaean construction of the Cold War. And in Niebuhr and other figures in the realist tradition, I think we actually have a way of thinking of that conflict in non-Manichaean terms. And we need to recover that now if we're going to disabuse ourselves of this, you know, this Manichaean moment that's eating away at our body politic as we speak.
And it's great that it's one of the more explicitly not about religion books that he writes, but he still uses kind of that basis of the parable you mentioned and the be as shrewd as snakes and what innocent as doves. Love that. All right. So let's hop into it. Now, this might take a second to set up. So my research back when I did such things was on Niebuhr and the Technological Society. And so Zach and I have been looking for a way to bring in some of the thinkers I engaged with in my dissertation. So we decided to do a series on Niebuhr and technology. And the first paper, just on a cursory Google search, I hadn't even gotten my like EBSCO privileges yet to download papers. So this is at the very beginning. And it was maybe like the day after I got accepted. And I came across this article by one, Jeremy Sabella. I found the title on Google, but I didn't have access to it. So I emailed Jeremy out of the blue. Didn't know who this Joker was. and I asked him for a PDF, and he very graciously and encouragingly sent it right over. It was a warm engagement. And here we are today. He's a five-timer on my show, Humble Beginnings. Now, the essay is called Poets and Prophets in a Machine Age, Reinhold Niebuhr on Technology. It was published in 2012. So the way this is going to work is Zach and I have both read the article and prepared questions. Zach, you want to take the first one?
Yeah, well, considering you've been on five times, we probably don't need to ask you why Niebuhr. Probably have that a few times. But I was curious, what's the backstory with this article? Because, why did you end up writing this?
Well, it, it's partly me negotiating the anxiety of what's my first article going to be, right? Being in grad school, knowing that I would need to start building up my CV, where would I first drill down? And it was just in the process of doing research for my dissertation, I noticed this motif of Niebuhr talking a lot about technological advances and the moral and ethical questions that they raised and how American society just doesn't bother paying attention to these questions, right? It's like this kind of like refrain that kept cropping up, and it's, you know, Niebuhr first starts talking about it in like the late 20s and early 30s, but it like, you know, resurfaces again like the 1950s. So it's this thing that he kind of, this pattern that he saw that that reemerged one decade after another for him. And I just realized, like, actually, I don't think anybody's written on this, because it's just, you have to be really in the weeds of working on Niebuhr, as I was for the dissertation, to start realizing, oh, this is something that he talks about in, it's not often, not in like these dedicated ways where like, it's not that what the piece is about necessarily, but he has this aside where he's talking about technology and talking about religion and science and stuff like that. So that felt like a straightforward way to get something out there, right? Just pull out this one theme that Niebuhr touched on that others didn't seem to be talking about. But yeah, it was a fairly typical grad school track in that way. I submitted it as a paper proposal to like a regional showing of the American Academy, you know, a regional conference of the American Academy of Religion. It got accepted. I presented it, and a person affiliated with the journal I published in, you know, was at the talk. And it's like classic, like there are eight people at the talk type things, right? You're presenting to a mostly empty room. But in this case, it was somebody who was affiliated with the journal who's like, this is actually a really interesting piece. If you want to polish it up and turn it into an article, we'd be interested in seeing it. So that was the genesis of it. But it's a good lesson for me as an academic of learning to trust my gut, where I just had this intuition that this would be an interesting thing to write about. And as I got into writing it, the facts supporting the intuition emerged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was a good kind of like confidence booster in that way of like, okay, like I need to learn to trust my gut as an academic and as a thinker.
Well, it sort of has like a timeless, the article has sort of a, minus the few references to like specific kind of global events, it has kind of a timeless insight. It offers like kind of timeless insights, I guess you could say.
And that's actually precisely why I was drawn to what Niebuhr had to say about technology, because it didn't feel time bound. Like, yes, he's writing in these very different moments in the 30s and the 50s, but it felt to me like it was really, the insights were really solid insights for the post-industrial age. Like wherever that takes us from here, like anytime, you know, from like the mid 1800s onward, right? The insights that Niebuhr has really kind of get at something that's important for us to pay attention to. So I would agree, there is kind of a timelessness to how Niebuhr's approaching these themes.
One comment about the weeds, and by the way, for our audience, I'm glowing right now because this is so like my thing. I'm like Niebuhr and technology, it still excites me. After all these years, I don't know why, but it does. I love this topic. But kind of going off of something you just said, and something that I struggled over, I had a really hard time at first kind of cobbling together a cohesive theory or dialectic with Niebuhr uses, you know, which Niebuhr uses explicitly with technology. He's not like you open up any book from the Frankfurt School and it's there. Or his friend Lewis Mumford, like it's all about that stuff. But with him, it is kind of scattered. And you reference Charles McDaniel here, who we're going to have later on in this series. But I'm going to read you a quote from your paper, and I kind of want you to explain this more if you can. You say, underlying the various ways that Niebuhr developed and altered his thought to take into account the massive political and social changes that transpired over the course of his life was a remarkably consistent understanding of technology's larger implications. In a way, this is me now, in a way, it sounds like you're saying that Niebuhr is actually always responding to technology. And you see it in the way that he adapts to the times. Is that fair?
To a certain extent, yeah. I mean, I think it's not like a conscious thing on Niebuhr's part, but, you know, as a thinker, people who engage Niebuhr and kind of get into like how different he sounds in the 30s versus what he sounds like in the 50s and 60s, et cetera, tend to see him as, it can be easy to feel like, where's the core to what he's doing? Because it's just, it feels and sounds so different as the times around him shift. My experience with Niebuhr was different. Maybe it's just my training in systematic theology, but to me, I basically realized, no, he has these core concerns that he carries through all these decades, and the final product sounds different because the world around him is changing so much. Mm-hmm. So the way I put it in the article is, you know, he was born in 1892, like the telephone as a technology was 15 years old.
Yeah.
Right. So it's basically like, you know, he is as far removed from the telephone as we are from the start of Facebook, basically.
Yeah.
That's and by the time he died in the early 70s, I mean, we had put humans on the moon at that point and built nuclear bombs. And, you know, so it's just this explosion of technological proficiency. So given Niebuhr's overwhelming drive to speak to the moment, right? If you're going to speak to a moment that's just where the world's just transforming in these really intense ways because of these technological developments, you're going to have to talk about technology, and you're going to have to develop a theory of how to think of technology as an ethicist. Yeah. And so that's kind of what I see going on with Niebuhr there.
When he was born, people were still riding horses into town.
Yeah.
By the time he died, there are ICBMs. And and I looked it up. Actually, he died 5 years into the World Trade Center's existence, which is for some reason crazy to me that Niebuhr was in New York while that was being built. And I looked this up also. The Bee Gees were recording when when he died. Pretty crazy, man.
My question, it's, you know, kind of a couple of my questions today are kind of about like the terms that Niebuhr uses and trying to understand. Because there's a lot of this article that he put forward is obviously a relationship between religion and scientific knowledge, like spiritual insights and scientific insights. And one of the questions I had that just kind of kept coming up to me is, what did Niebuhr mean by religion?
You know, I think when he's talking about tech, really, I think what he's talking about more is just a religious impulse, right? I don't think he's talking about like the brick and mortar aspects of religion, the institutional aspects of religion. I think he's thinking more on this impulse that he does think is universal to, you know, try to understand how everything fits together. And in that process, you encounter this sense of wonder and you ask questions about God and mm-hmm. ask yourself about what your obligations to your neighbor are. And, you know, what does it mean to live in community with other people who are seeking to love God and love their neighbor. So, you know, the way he uses it here, frankly, it's pretty simplistic. Like he really is just saying, it's a very kind of romanticist understanding of like, you know what, we have this desire, this yearning to connect. We have this yearning to worship. We have this innate sense of wonder. Follow that impulse through, we end up on the territory of community and ritual and religion.
It might be helpful to start with the poetic and then whatever the poetic does and offers, that mindset is kind of what he's talking about with the religious sphere, maybe.
Yeah, because it is, you know, he's drawing this distinction between religion and science where he talks about science's investment in the concrete and religion, you know, with this like broad scope. But then he goes on to talk later on about the relationship between the poetic and the prophetic. And the poetic is running with the impulse of wonder and all the rest. The prophetic is doing something different. It's trying to discipline and channel that impulse. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, for Niebuhr, right, the poetic and the prophetic are both part of religion writ large.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, going the poetic impulse for him, it's synthetic. It's seeking connection. It's seeking to unlock these questions of wonder and meaning and the things that elicit that wonder, that inspire this search for deeper significance, that help us to feel that the world's enchanted in some way. Mm-hmm. That's the poetic. And he ends up contrasting that with the scientific impulse, which on Niebuhr's telling, you know, obviously the scientific impulse, you can make a case humans have always possessed it. I think Niebuhr would make that case. But it doesn't become, you know, doesn't come front and center in society until the industrial era on Niebuhr's telling.
Well, because immediately when I was reading what he said about religion, I immediately thought of a very strong foundationalist, I think it's the word, foundationalist forms of Christianity. Like they try to employ science to prove every aspect of, you know, like Tin Ham and the Ark, right? Like they're taking a certain very strange scientism in some sense.
And listen, for the audience members that understand the Ken Ham and the Ark reference without further prompting, God bless you. but yeah, no, that is this when I teach the fundamentalist turn in American thought, I actually teach fundamentalism not as regressive but as hypermodern. It's really doubling down on no, we can actually create a synthesis using the tools of hard science and bring that together with the Bible. And
well, they're betraying, like from what you're saying from the article, they're betraying one of the foundational pieces of spirituality by doing that.
Absolutely. So for Niebuhr, trying to make faith about certainty, epistemic certainty, is a fool's errand, right? The whole point of faith is that it allows you to sit with the uncertain. Mm-hmm. And the unquantifiable and the things that you can't measure and put into words. And it allows you to wrap your arms around that and to be shaped by that. And so this process of trying to nail down, you know, precisely like how many days old the earth is for him, that's just not even a religious question. It wouldn't have interested him.
You note from his article on Tyranny of Science that the apparent progress in science has kind of given it this aura of authority that in many ways has supplanted religious authority. Where are we now? Do you think the balance is starting to shift back maybe a little bit? Do you think that kind of maybe some of our fears about AI and some other things, there might be some potential there of, or just modern media? Just the way that media and social media have this knack for cloistering us into these echo chambers. And it seems like people are somewhat getting disenchanted, and that just might be me, I don't know, somewhat getting disenchanted by the disparity between what we're being told and what the reality is in the world. Do you think that there's any chance of kind of swinging back to something that looks more religious than science?
Well, so just a brief chronology of how I think Niebuhr understands this. I think he'd make the case that, you know, pre-industrial age, who did we go to when we wanted to say, we want to know how the world works? Who do we turn to answer that question? In a pre-industrial age, that was religious leaders. Mm-hmm. Niebuhr being Niebuhr, that, you know, he'll tell you that's not an uncomplicated thing. You know, religious leaders kind of like, grew complacent with the power of having that place in society and misused that authority in all sorts of ways, right? So he owns the fact that religion wasn't always a good steward of that ability, or the fact that they were the de facto place where people went to understand how the world worked. Mm-hmm. With the industrial age, the Enlightenment, and the rise of the Industrial Revolution, you see this gravitational shift away from religion towards science as holding the master key that explained how the world worked. Mm-hmm. So you ask the same question, how does the world work? In the mid 1800s, you're no longer going to religious leaders for that question. right? You're going to scientists, and that trend line only increases as we get into the 20th century, where more and more it's just like, no, if you want to understand the way the world works, science is the one, is the discipline that can tell you that. And so by the mid 20th century, you know, Niebuhr wrote this piece in 1954 called The Tyranny of Science. I mean, the title tells you something, right? Where he is drawing this implicit parallel with, like, you know, maybe a certain period, like right around the Reformation, right? Where it's you have one religious organization that has this monopoly on telling you how the world works, at least in a European context. And Niebuhr's saying that by the 1950s, like, scientists hold that authority in American society. And he basically says this is alarming for all sorts of reasons, right? Like, the tools of science are really valuable and useful and help us understand various aspects of the world, but they're actually not good tools for answering ultimate questions. Mm-hmm. And if we keep going to science to answer ultimate questions, we're going to just keep getting mired in frustration and contradiction. It's not going to get us anywhere. Mm-hmm. So to Cliff's point about whether we're perhaps at a tipping point, I do think we are. I think we're finally at the point where our technological prowess is freaking us out.
Yeah.
And we're finally at the point where, you know, there's this kind of cultural sense of, like, did we just create Frankenstein's monster with AI?
I was just going to say that, because that's Frankenstein is actually kind of the first hint of our real anxiety for what's happening in the Industrial Revolution. And yeah, I'm wondering about, and we're seeing that more and more in Hollywood with things like Black Mirror and Jurassic Park. I mean, there's a whole lot out there on just kind of our, we don't feel good about this, you know, where we're going.
No, so I do think that creates a window to move away from scientific prestige and kind of watching the kind of, like, awkward, you know, the awkward missteps of, like, these Silicon Valley titans, I think, is also part of this as well, right? Whether it's Zuckerberg, you know, neglecting to answer basic questions before Congress, or, like, whether it's Elon just being Elon, like, the idea of Silicon Valley holding some kind of master key that tells us how the world works is people aren't buying it anymore, right? Right. I think scientific prestige is a case to be made that it's been demystified. And to me, I'm tempted to see a parallel with, like, the demystification of the indulgence system right around the time that Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door, right? There's actually very little in those theses that would have been considered particularly inflammatory in context. It's just that Luther was making those arguments about the indulgence system at a moment where people had started to lose faith in it as a system. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if we're at a point where we've kind of lost faith in Silicon Valley as being able to provide the answers. And maybe that does create an opening for people to start acknowledging, okay, maybe we need to put some shackles on our scientific prowess and look to other disciplines to help us discipline and channel it in a better way.
What you're saying, Jeremy, I think would be music to the post-liberals' ears. Someone like Milbank, who we just had on, would love to hear your response. What's the danger of that, of going that route?
Well, I think...
I'm sorry for interrupting. I have a hard time distinguishing Milbank sometimes with Christian nationalism. But anyway, go ahead.
And I will say, like, I enjoyed your interview with Milbank. I learned a lot, and it was neat to get a feel for the person behind the writing through that interview. But I think for Niebuhr, you know, and this runs through this article, he isn't making a case for now we need to switch back to religion as holding the master key.
Yes.
He doesn't want that. He doesn't think that's a good idea. No one should hold the master key for Niebuhr.
Love it.
For him, it's about tension and, like, checks. And I mean, we could think of almost like a theory of democracy applying to epistemology and, you know, questions about ultimate things, where he's basically, no, we need to hold one another in tension. Mm. Right, this is where you see that he's a true pluralist. Like, for him, an ideal society is not a Christian society, it's a society where the Christians are in dialogue with everyone else, and everyone is like respecting each other and taking the best insights from one another and working out of productive tension.
And
in that productive tension between the, you know, these different groups with different formations and different views of how the world works, you end up with the best possible alternative given just the nature of how humans work and like the broken nature, you know, the broken character of human nature and all the rest. So for him, he's basically saying, no, we need religion and science. Religion and science need one another.
Yeah.
Right. They hold one another in this really productive tension. And we need to figure out how to embrace that tension.
And to kind of plug myself a little bit, my main like focus, like toward throughout my research was, how do we retain the anxiety? The anxiety is good, like if to a point, like we need to obviously find serenity above it. But having the anxiety about our power is really good. And narratives are good for housing that. But it's really about understanding the perennial angst we face as we go forward in the future and realize that there's no easy way out of this. We can't just go out to the woods and live. And we can't just push through and rely on technology to save us. So we have to live in that constant tension. And really, that just tells us more about human nature, more about ourselves than anything. But the narratives are really important in housing that, I guess. So I guess that there is a point there for kind of the narrative theology people, but it has to be grounded within this push and pull and give and take, that there are lessons to be learned through our scientific exploration and so on. It's important to live in that tension.
It is. And that's actually, again, you know, one of Niebuhr's arguments for democracy. It comes back, as does his case for the tension between religion and science, to his theological anthropology, where he's basically saying humans are these strange spirit animal hybrids that, you know, are very much in the moment, but they also transcend their context. And that process of, you know, being stuck between, you know, being very much like a creature, but also having a spirit that transcends the creatureliness, generates tension. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's in Nature and Destiny of Man where he says the one edict that no human can ever not break is be not anxious. Mm. Right. Humans are anxious animals, right? We are, we can't help it. And it comes with the fact that we have such powers of imagination that is tied to the human spirit. And so for him, democracy was a tool for helping us manage that anxiety and manage that uncertainty, right? The totalitarian turns that we see in fascism or communism are buying into the lie that we can manage history and that we can manage humans. Right. We can't.
Yeah.
Right. Ask any parent if they can manage their kids.
Yeah. Exactly. Right? Exactly.
And if we can't even with our own kids manage them, how are whole societies going to manage people?
And I think the lesson here also is that yes, democracy is a goal, but even as we cling on to what's left of democracy here and try to maintain it, we have to recognize the fact that tension's still good here. That I find myself getting really frustrated by, you know, the gridlock of Congress, and why can't someone just come in and clean house, you know, and put things the way they're supposed to be. But we have to realize that tension is there for a reason. And that's, you know, you got to deal with that crappy stuff, man. So even within democracy, we have to be okay with that.
That's right. And, you know, and not just sort of be cheerleaders for a country when we're in power or when we win, right?
Right.
It's a broader commitment to a democratic project and to commit even when it's frustrating.
And this gets into your research now. I mean, not simplifying this into angels and demons, but it's a tense dance that we're doing here.
It's incredibly tense, and it is. It's when I do manage to have productive conversations with people on the other side of the spectrum from where I'm at. a lot of times they're not productive, right? They just kind of go off the rails pretty quickly. But when they are productive, I really do sense that we, both parties in that conversation, we both have to sit with a lot of discomfort and anxiety to break through to a point where it feels like, oh, we're actually communicating and we're actually hearing one another out. That's an anxious process. And it, you know, if I can bring it back to the article a little bit, I think, you know, when Niebuhr's talking about, like, you know, in pre-industrial societies, like, you can, you know, there's these organic bonds that people had to rely on. They had no choice, right? They had their small towns, and everybody in the small town had to learn to work together and, you know, deal with each other's foibles and all the rest, because their survival depended on it. And as a result, they developed these, like, really robust forms of community. One of the things that I think our technological prowess has done is it's given us the illusion that we can short circuit the, like, awkwardness and tension that comes with building relationships with other humans. It's a hard thing to do, and it's hard to work through those disagreements, and it's hard to sit in spaces where we're you know, not really connecting, not really hearing each other out. But doing so is, and learning how to do so and cultivating the skills to do so, is really important. And interacting through the interfaces of social media does not build those skills. It allows them to atrophy. And maybe that's part of the problem that we're encountering now.
So I'm going to take us in a different direction. That's
Cliff. Oh, can I, have one more point then?
Yeah, go for it, man. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, dude. And then we'll go right to you. I also find that, I think this last fall, there was some kind of big upheaval within the ChatGPT world, within AI corporate, of kind of oustering their CEO and him coming back in power. And there was all this anxiety about what are they doing behind this curtain. And a lot of people started freaking out, like, what's going on here? I kind of, and maybe this is totally misguided, I kind of interpreted that as a good thing. I'm glad that they're fighting, you know, and there is some tension existing in the AI world as they're progressing through this, because I think it would be terrifying if they weren't fighting.
Yes, they're neat. That tension is really important. And, you know, I taught a religion and technology class at Dartmouth in the fall, right? So it was like this really interesting time to be thinking through these questions with these really bright students. And
I'm jealous. That's cool.
It was a lot of fun. And you know, trying to figure out what these different chatbots think about religion, I had students, you know, take up that project and get to some really interesting places with it. So anyway, Zach, I think you had a question.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a setup to this. So there's a guy, Neil Van Leeuwen. He's got his degree from Stanford in philosophy, I believe. He kind of focuses on neuroscience and so that sort of thing. But he recently came out with a book this fall, and it's called Religion as Make-Believe, A Theory of Belief, Imagination, and Group Identity. And kind of the underlying idea in the book is that there are kind of fundamentally different, religious beliefs are kind of fundamentally different from factual beliefs in a person's cognition. They function more like imaginative play than realistic cognition. So basically what he sets up is that there are two kind of systems in the brain, one that deals with, like, mundane reality, and then one that adds, one that works with, like, imagined sacred significance sort of thing. In my mind, it adds some credibility to what you raise about Niebuhr's, like, hey guys, let's focus on using imagination and focus on using symbols and for our significance.
If you don't mind me, you know, picking
go
up
for
with
it. Yeah, please.
So I'm fine with, you know, religion as imaginative play angle, because, like, so much of the best things in life boil down to that, right? And even some of the things that structure reality at this basic level, what is our monetary system if not collective imaginative play? Right. There's no there behind the monetary system. We all agree that the dollar means something. And that's what gives it its power. Same thing with nations, right? What's a nation? It's a bunch of people that identify as being under the same government at the end of the day, right? And yes, we can talk about, like, there are all sorts of things that go with that. There's, you know, there's checkpoints at borders, there's passports, there are all these systems that enforce that intuition. But you know, we've watched governments crumble really quickly when, for whatever reason, the citizens stop believing in the credibility of their government, right? So it's just, we can't have human community or identify or human groups or really do much of anything as collectives without this exercise of imaginative play, without cultivating our ability to imagine and perceive things in this virtual way. So I actually don't find that thesis problematic at all. Although I think I would be inclined to say, like, actually, just because it's virtual doesn't make it any less real. We need to disabuse ourselves of digital dualism, of presuming that the virtual is somehow less real than the material.
That's a great point. You've made that before. I'm sorry, Zach, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, what do you think Niebuhr would make of that insight, I guess? That's the question I was trying to get to. Make it there.
I think he would mostly agree with it, but I think he would agree with it and he'd build on it. I think what he would say is the human ability to imagine is precisely what distinguishes humans from other animals.
And the capacity for anxiety. I'm sorry to keep
and the capacity for anxiety that comes
that
with
buzzword.
It, right?
Yeah.
Because the ability to imagine ties in with the sense of a future, right? We want to know what that future looks like. Not being able to know precisely what that future looks like generates anxiety. Humans are supposed to transmute that anxiety into trust in God. We find that incredibly difficult. Whatever original sin was, it was a failure to trust God with that anxiety. And that failure mucked everything else up, right? Like it's the source of why the human experiment kind of can go haywire sometimes, because we try to micromanage the future.
Yeah.
But we can't let ourselves do that. And if we're going to like thread that needle of imagining what might be, but still trusting God and trusting, more importantly, in this context of this conversation for Niebuhr, trusting one another, right? Instead of trying to lock down our version of the future, if we're going to thread that needle, we better cultivate tools of imagination that we're willing to discipline with the prophetic voice.
So getting into the meat kind of this essay, you talk about why technology is so challenging to assess ethically, because, you know, we're working without a template and it's kind of a moving target. History's never seen anything like this before. And you basically say that the only way we can regain, and I hope I'm summarizing this appropriately, but you basically say that the only way we can kind of regain our organic connections with one another is by abandoning our, quote, futile search for technological solutions for a decidedly non-technical need for wholeness. And this is where you introduce Niebuhr's poet and prophet roles. So I'm teeing it up for you. Can you unpack this? Why are these poet and prophet roles important for our society?
So, you know, one example that's just it's effective for getting at, you know, us seeking technological solutions to non-technical problems. It's a question I brought up in my classes before, which is, has Tinder simplified dating?
Interesting.
Right. It's an app that you can use to meet people. It like claims to short circuit all the messiness of like being out there and being vulnerable and going through like all the awkwardness that entails and gets you right to what you want. And then every time I ask the question, the answer is unequivocally no. If anything, it's made it more complicated. Right.
Yeah.
It was in certain ways simpler to meet people and build relationships with them and get intimate with them before there were apps that claimed to short circuit the process. And so that, I think, is a good illustration of like where the trying to meet a decidedly non-technological problem, how do we connect and become intimate with other humans through a technological means, is not going to work.
Yeah.
Right. That's not going to get us where we need to go. So for Niebuhr, it's, you know, like, why do we have, like, why is like romantic poetry a thing? Why do we have, so much culture built up around romance? one way of thinking about what Niebuhr is saying is, no, we need the poetic to even begin to describe what it is that we feel and want and desire when we're trying to connect intimately with others.
Love it.
And we have to access language that gives us a way of describing wonder, that gives us a way of being vulnerable, that allows us to negotiate these things that cannot be boiled down to nerve endings.
Right.
We're not going to get anywhere on a date, right? If we're just sitting there talking about neurons firing, right? Like that's not going to broker the connection. You need access to the poetic in some form, some fashion to broker that connection.
But do you think that some of that just has to do with complexity, just in terms of like, if we could unpack that complexity kind of as we are increasingly able to in kind of recent years, do you think that would push back on his perspective at all? So for instance, like, you know, they talk about, just to give you an example, coming up in the future, like if you get diagnosed with a mental disorder, they're saying that probably you won't get diagnosed with a single mental disorder. You get diagnosed with, like, it'll be like, you know, you have ADHD B47, you know, because it'll be so specific to that specific condition, like the specific way that your brain is having issues. Do you think that some of that like collapsing of complexity could change that at all?
Not really. So I think Niebuhr would look at that, like being able to deal with things like mental illness in these more granular ways, definitely a good thing, right? Zero questions about like that being a good thing and that being a useful thing. But what does the person with mental illness need after the diagnosis? They need somebody to come to them and be like, listen, we are so sorry that you've had to deal with this. Like, we want to, you know, walk with you through this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No matter how refined the diagnosis gets, right, at the end of the day, you know, what people need to hear is, we are sorry that this has made you feel isolated. We want to figure out how we can help you feel reintegrated,
mm-hmm.
With your communities, like feel reintegrated in your life and all these other things. Help us do that with you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And for Niebuhr, that move is of a different order than science. That's not something. So science can give us like the granular breakdowns of, you know, in ever more specificity, like in complexity, like here's the problem, here are the things that we can do to, you know, from a scientific standpoint to deal with the problem. But there's this whole relational piece that has to be there, where we're on the territory of the poetic. And it's something, you know, when I have conversations with people in my life who've overcome addiction, one of the things that they say that helped them was realizing, like, I told myself a lie about my own isolation being something that I deserved or something that was inevitable, and realized that what I needed to overcome this is to figure out how to reconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Such a simple insight.
So but I want to push further on that. So even we could talk about the issue of relationality. And that, I mean, there's certainly a promise out there right now that pervades, you know, certain circles, that even things like being the need for relationality will be subject to technology. Like I don't necessarily believe that, but I'm just saying there is definitely a promise out there that those things, those limitations, those, you know, your needs could be modified by technology.
I think on some level, Niebuhr would say that that's a pipe dream. Right. Like, you know, you're not going to be able to upload your consciousness to silicon. I don't think Niebuhr thought that would be a thing that would happen, or that would be in the realm of possibility or desirable. And, you know, who knows what time will tell whether that's that, you know, that insight gets borne out. But I think he would say, no, like, connecting is an inherently vulnerable thing. You have to risk something to get there. And there's no short-circuiting that risk. There's no short-circuiting the skills that we have to build to be in community with one another. We can't get around that. And one of the cultural impasses we've arrived by putting technology on this pedestal is that we have told ourselves there's a shortcut for everything. And his whole point is that that's not true. There are certain things that we cannot shortcut. And it's precisely the things that are most important that we cannot get around, right? That put us on the narrow and difficult path that lead to salvation. And we have to resist the temptation to be on the broad and easy path that leads to destruction.
And kind of to go off of that a little bit, we have to wonder how much technology is making us simplify the world as well, rather than taking it as it in its complexity, I guess. And maybe this is similar to the point of what you're talking about, Jeremy, with kind of short-circuiting things a little bit. I don't know if technology will ever be able to simplify things without us first buying into the illusion that it's more simple than it is.
Well, and the scientific method requires this, right? You have to isolate variables to execute the method. You have to be able to remove things from the kind of like flux of life in order to be able to subject them to scientific analysis. And for Niebuhr, like, of course, like that's how the scientific method works. That's how scientific knowledge works. It's really useful. Mm-hmm. But let's acknowledge the hard limits of that method, right? When you take things out of the flux of everything else, right? To understand how they relate, you know, integrate back into that flux, you need other tools to do that. Mm-hmm. Right. So that tendency to isolate, to understand things in ever more granular ways, again, incredibly useful. But science's ability to move in the opposite direction, it's not really there for Niebuhr. By the time you're moving in that opposite direction, you're on the domain of ethics and morality and religion, whether you're willing to admit that to yourself or not.
Right.
And so you might as well actually cultivate good tools rather than just presume that because you're a really good engineer, you know how to run social networks.
Yeah. And so one insight from Heidegger that I think is important is how technology changes us and the way we see the world as we are creating it and as we are engaging with it, this enframing process. And what happens with this is we actually create illusions about one another, and we boil one another down into human resources or the standing reserve. This is just a laborer. This is just a consumer. We simplify everything in this technological, scientific type of way. And we completely eliminate the organic, which is the real stuff about one another. If we're talking about the dating app, really, we're just kind of reducing human beings down to whatever they put as their interests, right? And is that really simplifying the process, or is it just simplifying us through an illusion? And it seems like that comes first. And I kind of come back to what Niebuhr famously say. I think you might reference it in this. I can't remember about we vainly imagine. You probably already know where I'm going with this. We vainly imagine the mastery of nature means the mastery of self, or he says something like that. So I think that there's this illusion that gets tacked on as baggage with technology that forces us to oversimplify everything as well. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's really kind of interesting to think of this almost as like, you know, I wonder if people would be tempted to kind of play with Marxist tropes about, right? Because like Marx famously describes religion as the opiate of the masses. I can imagine Niebuhr saying, actually, no, tech is the opiate of the masses.
Interesting.
Right? That's what generates these illusions that give everything a false simplicity, that like keep us occupied in ways where we don't actually change the things that need changing. Hmm. And if we want to get beyond the opiate, disabuse ourselves of it, we're going to have to reestablish organic connections and interact with each other and grant each other the complexity that we're due to one another, And then we might get somewhere, right? Then we might puncture through these illusions to a better way of operating in the world.
I got something weird for us guys to consider. So there's this theory called dead internet theory. It's the idea with the advent of AI, it's already escalating so quickly to the point where we are forming relationships with AI now, and we don't even know it online. So we could and it's escalating so quickly. We're engaging with more and more commercials or more videos on YouTube or personalities on social media that actually are just completely made up. Like these aren't real, to a point where they're saying that because this AI has the ability to adapt with us and constantly give us what we want, we're constantly getting this mirror to the point where we don't engage with other humans at all on the internet anymore. And it's just a void. It's just a giant mirror that we are seeing ourselves within. The next step in this, I think, is kind of this uncanny valley impulse we have as human beings, where we see something that's not right and it about like a robot that looks too human, and we just, it gives us the ooey feelings. And I think that kind of I think I'm approaching that time where this just all seems just so weird that it just, like, I crave real human being interaction. So this is kind of a part of the an earlier question of, is there kind of a revolt coming away from this type of stuff? I don't know. Not a Luddite revolt, but like a, let's just be friends with people kind of thing.
Well, it's interesting because I think, like, it almost seems like, I mean, Jonathan Haddett, I think is his name, his book, The Anxious Generation, it's been making the rounds on Twitter. And it's interesting because pretty much the insights that he draws, basically kids shouldn't have cell phones, smartphones. And it's interesting, though, because I thought of that book many times as I was reading this article by Jeremy, is it almost, Niebuhr could almost foresee this, the disconnection and the I mean, he didn't have the specifics of these issues, but he definitely had an insight into what, for instance, mass communication would do to people and how it would break down relationships.
The thing about that, though, with the guy creating this rule, in it itself is probably, I don't know, ambiguous, but it could be good, could be bad. But I hate taking Niebuhr and trying to create rules off of it. And, you know, like, something that I always tried to avoid is saying, okay, therefore we shouldn't be on our phones all the time, because there's certain things that are really good about it, I guess.
Yeah. So actually, that was one of the insights of Niebuhr's when he's talking about TV in the 50s, right? It's such a different moment. But he's already basically saying, like, the problem with mass media is that it treats culture as a commodity to be gained for basically profit and position. And it gets at something really powerful today, right? Like, it is. It's like we can, mass media still treats culture as a commodity to be exploited. And through social media, we've started kind of commodifying one another, right? I actually see like some powerful insights into social media. Would Niebuhr say put your phones away? I actually don't think so, but I think he would applaud like the tendency in Gen Z to just like start using flip phones, mm-hmm. right? Like, maybe we should have devices for you know, for one task. Ask instead of trying to squeeze every single possible task into one device, right? Have a phone be for talking to people. Right? Is that so bad? You know, I do, but yeah, I do wonder if we're getting to the point with AI of just mass disenchantment, right? Where this whole kind of thing that we've been cultivating in online space, all these avatars and these conversations and these apps and all these things, the allure is starting to come off of that. And we're starting to realize that I don't want to be somebody who just spends my life in these virtual spaces all the time.
And we've seen these revolutions before in history. I mean, on the eve of the Reformation movement, I mean, who could have predicted that a little German monk is going to start this big thing that's going to, you know, radically change Christianity, you know? So yeah. Okay. So I think we each have one more question. Zach, you want to do it?
Yeah. So, Jeremy, you wrote, Niebuhr concludes that to fulfill their role as spiritual leaders in a technological age, prophets must become technicians and poets must become philosophers. Religion, which grew naturally out of the heart of the peasant, can live in a more complex era only by collaboration of prophets who are also technicians with poets who are also philosophers. So my question is, could you unpack for us what is Niebuhr talking about when he says that prophets must be technicians?
Yeah, prophets as technicians and poets as philosophers. It's basically Niebuhr trying to grapple with, like, okay, like, we can't just go back to a pre-industrial age where, like, people seem to have this kind of, like, relatively uncomplicated sense of, you know, here are the ultimate things that I care about. Here's the God I believe in. Here are the practices that I hold true, right? We can't go back to that. There's no going back. But how do you honor the spirit of that? How do you reintroduce this sense of religious wonder and ability to connect with one another and ability to build robust communities in a post-industrial age? And he basically tells poets and prophets, like, you're going to need other tools to make sense of your age in a way that can actually build this within that context. So for the poet, right, don't just throw out a bunch of like nice sounding symbols, right? You're going to need some systematic and analytic rigor to figure out how those symbols touch down in a post-industrial age, mm-hmm. right? You need philosophers who paid very close attention to that post-industrial switch to help guide you, right, into structuring how you present poetry in a way that can land for a post-industrial audience. Mm-hmm. And same thing with the prophet, right? Yes, I mean, you can rant like an Old Testament prophet if you want, but if you haven't done the work of really digging into the malaise of your time, right, really understanding the ins and outs of how modern society works, that poetic message will not land. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's where he uses the language of technician, which is like a very kind of like machine age type of term. Right. You poets have to become pedagogical technicians. They have to become social technicians. Right. They have to understand, OK, this is how people process information in a scientific age. Mm-hmm. Right. Master a sense of what that processing looks like and how to speak to people who are processing in those terms. This is what sociality can look like in a scientific age, right? What does it look like to build robust communities when we all have smartphones in our pockets? Mm-hmm. Prophets need to think about that.
Yeah.
And telling people to just throw out their smartphones is not going to work. Getting them to think really carefully, like, what kind of person do you want to be? How is that device in your pocket shaping you? And how can you draw on these thicker forms of community to help you be a better steward of that device in your pocket so that it isn't so much shaping you, but you're able to exercise some agency in creating the kinds of community that are actually healthy through that device, right? For Niebuhr, the prophet needs to think carefully about those questions. So it's a different look at the prophetic in particular, because we think of the prophet as somebody that's calling us restorationists, right? Calling us back to something. And Niebuhr's saying, listen, that's all well and good, but for that to mean anything, you have to have a deep knowledge of what's right in front of you and how it works.
I know you're almost out of time, but is there anybody that stands out to you that embodies that now?
You know, I mean, there are people who I think are very careful analysts of our current moment and how it's affecting the way that we socialize. You know, I still teach this book in my classes called Twitter and Tear Gas by a scholar named Zeynep Tufekci. And basically, she's examining how our ecologies of communication have changed and how that like transformed the face of how social movements work and how social change happens. She analyzes the Arab Spring in particular, which I think is really useful. There's another book by a scholar named Kate Crawford called The Atlas of AI, which I think is actually a really interesting book, because what Kate Crawford is really disciplined about is getting us to pay attention to the fact that, you know, we think of AI as this virtual thing. And she says it's absolutely not virtual. Right? It has this vast material footprint that manifests in these massive databases that are using enormous amounts of electricity, that touches on, you know, rare earths mines that are like poisoning local populations in different parts of the planet, that are like, you know, that, you know, rely on, you know, people in all sorts of like parts of the developing world who have to like manually take dangerous content off of the internet and off of AI databases, mm-hmm. right? There's this vast human footprint behind AI, and we need to pay attention to it. Those are the two works that come to mind as at least threading the ethical piece of this, right? Really getting us to think carefully about like, here's been this massive technological shift. What does this mean for ethics? How can we think ethically in light of these shifts? And, you know, think ethically in ways that take these technologies and these shifts seriously. So those are just two figures that come to mind. I know there are plenty more.
We had some friends from Japan on recently. It won't be published until after the series, I don't think. But they're having a problem where Christianity is a super minority in Japan, and it's dying more and more day by day. Yet they still want to retain Niebuhr. And so I suggested, is there any way you can inject Niebuhr as a lens into Japanese pop culture through other avenues, fiction, movies, even tap into Japanese mythology to draw out more Niebuhrian tensions? And we actually ended up discussing Godzilla a little, which was great. But you have to listen to it all, audience, when it comes out. But to your point, if something like irony is important for the prophet, how can we channel that message without Niebuhr's given form of Christian dominance or academia even in American culture? Where does the rubber meet the road? We got this great idea. How do we get it out there?
Well, for Niebuhr, you know, the way that he lays out this whole analysis of technology, it actually really isn't that reliant on Christian categories.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. He really is just talking about the religious impulse writ large and how, you know, how to use that impulse to help bring, you know, and put it in tension with scientific prowess and how to use the categories of the poet and prophet to bring it all together. So I see it as a very kind of like pluralist society friendly argument from the jump. Obviously Niebuhr himself gave it Christian content, but I don't think it would bother him in the least to say, okay, let's spin these ideas out in a non-Christian context. Mm-hmm. Right. Because for Niebuhr, it's like, you know, this is a matter of, you know, it was axiomatic that, you know, like people, non-Christians are just as spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. They have that same built-in yearning to connect to something bigger than them. And as long as you can tap into that yearning, whatever that looks like in a particular cultural context, you can find that balance between religion and science, even if it manifests in different ways with slightly, you know, with different cultural contexts to help structure that tension.
Jeremy Sabella, five-timer club honoree. Once again, it was a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thank you so much.
And good luck to you, buddy.
Thank you.
That about does it for this week's episode of the Love Thy Neighbor podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe. Push all the buttons. Follow us on Twitter at Love Thy Neighbor. Give us a shout out, especially if you have any questions or comments. You want us to check out any new scholars out there, let us know. Until next time, everybody, take care and stay safe out there.